People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing.
But the net zero madness is closing down factories, is closing down industry on a scale we couldn't have even believed today.
My administration has taken action to abolish all discriminatory diversity, equity, and inclusion nonsense.
Never mind the planet.
Here we go again. All right. Thank you very much for joining this episode, our second episode of Never Mind the Planet. And I'm joined, as usual, by our co-hosts, Dr. Ebenezer Laye, reader in sustainable development law at Aston University, and Dr. Shay Omolosho, associate professor in sustainable business at the University of Northampton Center for Sustainable Business Practices. And actually, Shay, I think it's since the last podcast, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think you've become associate professor. I think you weren't associate professor in the last podcast. Have I got that right? Or had I just got it completely wrong in the last podcast?
No, I think you've gotten it. I think it happened simultaneously, I would say. I'll give you the pass.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Congratulations
for the promotion to associate professor. And for those of us non-academics who aren't familiar with the sort of the various different sort of titles and letters, what's an associate professor?
So the associate professor role is the step before the full professorship, especially in some universities. Some universities use a different promotional levels, but at the University of Northampton, we have the associate professor level, which is the level just before the full professorship, and it demonstrates significant contributions to research or enterprise, as it might apply. In my case, is mostly on the enterprise side, looking at impact of my activities on businesses, really, and on the wider society.
Great. Well, that's amazing. So on the road to professorship, congratulations, Shay. It's good to surround myself in all these big brains, as we've got, of course, Dr. Ebenezer, who I believe you're also an associate professor, or forgive me if I've got that completely wrong, but you're also an associate professor as well, is that right?
Yes, very. Thank you so much, Simon. And great to be on a podcast, and hi to everyone who's listening. So I'm a reader, so it's a very, nifty title. Just to explain and to sort of that's used for someone who is in between an associate professor and what we call a chaired professor. All very confusing, but yeah, basically it's a professor without chair. I'm not sure whether I've confused our listeners even more or made it simpler, but there we are.
Oh, of course, yeah, a professor without a chair. I mean, they could have at least given you a chair. I don't know how you manage to sit down, but old joke you've heard lots of times.
Exactly, Simon, exactly.
And, of course, I'm Simon, jack of all trades, of master of none, but some call me, and also the founder of the Sustainable Business Alliance, and honoured to be joined by Ebenezer and Shay once again for these podcasts. A lot's happened since our last one a few weeks ago, and I know we've all been away in various places. I think the two of you have been away in Bangladesh over the last few weeks. I was in Ghana and Benin. Obviously lots for us to reflect on, as well as everything that's happened in the world very much recently. But just quickly, reflections on your trip to Bangladesh. What was the purpose of it? How did it go? Did you achieve what you wanted to?
Yeah, thanks, Simon. Yeah, it was an amazing trip. So the purpose of the trip was to really advance elements of the project we have running in Bangladesh called the Leather Trace Project. And this is a project where we're developing and piloting a traceability system within the leather sector in Bangladesh. And the purpose of that system is to provide the digital means and enablement which allows tanneries in Bangladesh to demonstrate their compliance with global climate policies, particularly around deforestation, so that they can maintain access to global markets. And so, of course, as I'm sure one can imagine, this is a project which, by good grace of God, has high impact. And so we were down there in Bangladesh, had a lovely time. We ran a few workshops with tanneries, and we met local partners as well. And we also delivered a policy workshop where we engaged with stakeholders. We engaged with representatives from the government as well in Bangladesh on the subject of identifying the key policy structures that are needed to enhance the upscaling and wide adoption, really, of traceability technologies in Bangladesh within the tannery sector. And we were able to get a lot of data from that meeting and that workshop, which of course we're going to translate and transcribe and analyze into a policy blueprint, which of course hopefully will be adopted by good grace of God by the government in Bangladesh, which will be a first for any such country in the global south. So yeah, fantastic visit, fantastic outcomes, and yeah, amazing stuff.
Wow, great. No, amazing to hear, and really impressive. Look forward to hearing all about how that goes. So yeah, keep us informed on future episodes. And yeah, once it's published, it'd be great to hear about it. So well, fantastic. Well, let's move on. And you know, as I said, lots going on in the world. So Shay, over to you. What news shall we talk about this week?
Right. Sorry, Remy. There's so many things going on at the moment, but we only have a short time, and we would have a chance to discuss a number of key issues that we are seeing in the news, which are also recent and applicable to all of us listeners, I would say. So, first up is related to sustainable sourcing and conflict zones in the world. And in relation to that, we saw that the UK's co-op group will stop sourcing from 17 countries, and including Israel and Russia, citing human rights and international law concerns. But then this raises some ethical questions, such as should businesses stop buying from conflict countries, and what could be the operational, reputational and moral risks of such a move. And I'll leave that to you, Simon and Ebenezer, with input from myself as well, to discuss later. Secondly, there is an ongoing discussions in relation to the Global Plastics Treaty and bioplastics. And we know that there is a huge debate on the impact of bioplastics as well. So there are talks ongoing between the United Nations in Geneva and key stakeholders. And these talks aim to create a legally binding treaty to tackle plastic pollution across its entire life cycle. Of course, we see that progress is slow, with over 200 industry lobbyists influencing negotiations. I mean, how could it be fast with that? Then how do businesses respond? The current and upcoming regulations favor plastic alternatives. Do they favor plastics over alternatives, and are bioplastics as sustainable as claimed? How do we avoid the greenwash that could be related to this? Just for further context, tariffs on plastic and rubber are falling from 34% to 7.2% over the last 30 years, while plant-based alternatives face higher tariffs, averaging about 14.4%. So that's another spicy set of statistics there, just to aid our discussion. And thirdly, looking at the Earth Overshoot Day and the economic paradox as a result of that. So at the moment, we as a planet, we are consuming about 1.8 times faster than the Earth can regenerate. And this raises the question, the paradoxical question, how do we consume less while businesses relying on selling more and also consumers also consuming more? How does that cause an issue or solve the issue of the overconsumption that we are facing? So we could look at concepts like donut economics as possible frameworks. There is other concepts like the degrowth concept as well that we could look at. So a lot of things to think about, a lot of things to talk about. But without further ado, I will pass the ball back to you, Sam.
Wow, great. Gosh, lots of big topics to get stuck into this week. None of them are easy topics at all, but I'm sure there are others as well. But these three, I don't know how we're going to cover those in the time we've got remaining, but we're going to give it a go. So firstly, as you mentioned, sustainable sourcing and conflict zones, and that report from the co-op group that's going to stop sourcing from 17 countries, including Israel and Russia, due to human rights and international law concerns. So I guess, you know, how do we tackle this? Because as you say, Shay, there's an ethical question here. Should we stop buying from countries in conflict? And of course, it almost seems like the obvious answer is yes. Yes, of course we should. But actually, when you kind of think about it, you know, there are people who aren't involved in politics, who aren't involved in making decisions around going into conflict, whose livelihoods are at stake here. You know, when it comes to, you know, obviously, if we're talking about co-op, if we're talking about produce, if we're talking about food, you know, we could be talking about farmers here whose access to markets have been, you know, shut down. You know, they're not to blame for the conflict and, you know, concerns over human rights that may not affect them. Well, they may not be responsible, but still this is what you could call a sort of blanket restriction on buying from that particular area. Now, is that right? Is this the right approach? What do you think, Ebenezer?
Yeah, thanks, Simon. I mean, it is an interesting but very tricky development, I feel. I think ethically it's set in the right way, and it raises a real question, as you rightly put it, Simon, which is that should we consider putting a pause on sourcing from conflict zones? I really think the answer really depends on the circumstances around the countries that we want to stop sourcing from and what their roles are in the conflict, right? Of course, if you talk about Russia, for example, where they have been the aggressor and they have attacked Ukraine, some might say, well, given the fact that they have attacked a peaceful neighbor in a way that is unjustified because it is an unprovoked attack, then yes, it may make sense to stop sourcing from that country. The reason being that by sourcing from them, you are providing finances, right? You know, if you buy from that country, you are indirectly, potentially providing finances that indirectly finds its way into the support system for the war machine to continue going. And I think we've seen in the news recently some of the concerns coming out of the White House in the United States where the Trump administration, for example, is trying to push the needle when it comes to India, and trying to get India to stop buying Russian oil. And they're trying to use the tariff system to do that. So all of this comes from a concern of, positions or economic ties, which may end up fueling, the war machine. So I think it's an important question. I think it's a question that remains to be answered. But I think the answer really lies, in the circumstances. If it is a policy that comes in against an aggressor country, such as Russia, where the position is that we're going to stop sourcing from that particular country or others like it that are in conflict because they are attacking other countries in an unprovoked way, then I think that that strikes me as being absolutely right and ethical. But you don't want to be in a situation where that policy is carried out against countries like Ukraine that are in a position where they're trying to defend themselves from aggression. So that's how I would view that.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, but I agree with what you're saying, and I guess where my concern is there a risk that by stopping sourcing from a particular country because they're involved in conflict, that it encourages or maybe even legitimizes discrimination against the people within those countries who aren't responsible, who may not even support the action that their country is taking, and ultimately ends up marginalizing them because they're not able to access markets. So it's the right move, if a country is an aggressor, which is doing so against international laws, and there's big moral questions about what they're doing. But I guess, how do we find the right balance to ensure that the people who may not be involved, who may not support what the government is doing, aren't, sort of unfairly punished? Or maybe actually that's just the price that has to be paid. I don't know. It's a difficult one.
Yeah, I think I completely agree with what you said as well about these questions that you've raised. I agree with those questions because there is a chance here that people that are not even in support of the conflict or the war or the aggression, they're also suffering from the sourcing ban. But I think even in addition to that as well, we could look at the further implications of policies like this. If every business like Co-op wants to stop sourcing from these conflict countries, the question would then be, what would be the implication of that on consumers as well? Could it lead to more expensive produce? For example, I know Co-op mentioned from the news article that they released, Mali is also one of those countries, and they source mango from Mali, for example. And from my trip to Ghana last year, actually, I think yourself and Ebenezer were on that same trip as well, where there was a mango safari by one of the companies that we work with in Ghana, just to look for mangoes all around. So could that have implications as well for consumers? And I think the answer could be yes. Could that mean more expensive produce in the stores? That could be the case as well. But as a result, the last question that you ask, is this the price that we all have to pay on the consumer side, but also for businesses and individuals in those countries where sourcing would stop? And then I have a very spicy question as well. Now, if we are stopping sourcing from these 17 countries, what about the countries that are actually supporting some of this aggression, aggression in quotes, countries, such as Israel is now seen, deemed as an aggression country. But in the past, we know that they've also seen support from the UK and the US. So what is the role of the support countries for the aggression countries? What does that have to do when it comes to answering this ethical question, when it comes to stopping sourcing from certain countries? So there's a lot of cross currents, I would say, a lot of questions, probably not enough answers, given how dicey the issues are.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, it is a difficult question. I mean, where do you draw the line? And I guess, good to understand, where this is coming from, I guess, sort of a policy position. Is this being driven by consumers, expecting, particular organizations, retailers, to have a strong stance when it comes to their sourcing? That we shouldn't be buying from these conflict zones or these areas that have questions about human rights, or is it sort of particular sort of NGOs, United Nations bodies who are making these recommendations around sourcing? Now, we saw, of course, when Russia invaded Ukraine, there was an overwhelming move from countries around the world to stop trading with Russia. And of course, a lot of it was around energy and oil and banking, and finance, etc. But of course, it did also cross over into consumer goods. We saw a lot of brands declaring they would stop trading in and with Russia, closing down branches. Of course that had and still has implications. And we know, of course, part of the reason is to penalize Russia and other countries in a similar position for the for what they have done, and to hopefully incentivize stopping it. But it hasn't worked. We're still in the situation that we are in now. I guess, without wanting to go too far down the political route, I guess it's, back to where I was coming from with this question. Where is this coming from when it comes to policymakers within retailers and brands? Is it consumers that are pushing for this? Or what could it be? Ebenezer, do you have a view on this?
Yeah, thanks, Simon. I think it's a very important question in terms of what the driving force is. I think personally, from what I observed, having read around the issue and having looked at different bits of data, the consumer angle cannot be ignored. It is often the case that whether it's in the food retail sector or whether it's in the clothes retail sector, whatever area it is, brands are often always responding to what their customers are saying and what consumers are saying. And so I think this has a lot to do with the sentiment and the strong sense of feeling that people have in the world today and have had over the last 2 years. About these geopolitical events that are taking place around the world, where there is clearly immense suffering. There is a lot of loss of life. And, we see on our TV screens every day the very moving pictures of fellow human beings who are struggling in places where there is an immense need for humanitarian support, and there is an urgent need for the fighting to stop. And I think that has bubbled up into a very strong feeling, particularly here in the UK, as it is the case all across the world, but we are in the UK, so better to contextualize it for us in the UK. But we see in the UK in on the streets different protests, particularly around the war in Gaza, and a strong sense of feeling there, which people have, which has in many ways even evolved into a strong sense of mission that some people feel about the steps that they feel that they need to take to help alleviate the situation and, you know, to bring calm and peace to that area. And that, in my view, has in some way found its expression in what consumers are saying to the brands that they buy from when they pick up a product and they notice that it's been made in one country or the other, where they now, you know, where they feel that that country is an aggressor, and they want to make their voices heard. So I think the consumer angle is a very, very important and powerful driving force, and has been when it comes to this issue. And I feel that a lot of what we're seeing in terms of the decisions that are being made around sourcing, are really coming from that side of things.
Yeah, and what I want to ask is, you know, is there a risk here? Is there a risk that, you know, brands, retailers might be seen to be taking sides? And, you know, that could be very dangerous. And in which case, how do you respond to that? You know, and how do you ensure that you're taking the right approach? We know very well how sensitive these issues can be, and how political these issues can be. And, you know, bottom line is, no one wants to see people suffering in the way that we're seeing people suffering on our TV screens right now, we're reading about in the press. And at the end of it, this all comes down to, you know, livelihoods, people's lives. People's lives are affected by conflict, but people's lives are also affected by the consequences of conflict and the actions that we take as well. So what's the right approach for businesses to take? You know, of course, we've been talking about the Co-op Group here, but, you know, many of people listening will be working in or running businesses that maybe aren't quite as big, or haven't adopted an approach to sourcing in the way that the Co-op have. Now, what should businesses be doing? What is the right approach? What is a balanced approach that businesses should take in this very tricky area when it comes to procuring their products and services, particularly when they're coming from areas of conflict or areas where there are human rights and international law concerns? What would your advice be? Who wants to tackle that one? Jay, do you want to have a go?
Yeah, why not? Right. So I think the approach that Co-op has taken, while it might raise some question, I think it's also probably important to see where they've come from. So this recent policy that they've implemented has been as a result of recommendations by the Co-op members, as they've mentioned. So they've mentioned from the news article that Co-op members have made clear through surveys and different modes of engagement that conflict is one of their big concerns, and they would love that Co-op do all it can to advocate for peace and build peace wherever possible. So Co-op has come to this decision as a result of a detailed analysis that took over a year, and they had three criteria that they followed to making this decision. So the first criteria was related to agreements from different assessments, including from the United Nations, that there is a consistent behavior that would constitute community-wide human rights abuses and violations of international law. And secondly, that the actions that Co-op, if possible, if they can take actions that will make a difference directly or indirectly to those affected and those affected with the conflict. And if the actions could alleviate suffering, they would want to take such actions. And finally, that the action that they would take would not negatively affect Co-op's integrity. So it seems like they have this framework and this mode, these policies of operations that this particular decision can be anchored. So I think looking at your stakeholders and getting a view of from them, looking at your consumers, because I think at the end of the day, you want to meet the needs of your stakeholders and your consumers. But the question about fairness and not taking sides also has a role to play when it comes to implementing policies like this. So perhaps the blanket banning of produce from these countries could have detrimental impact, of course, on the probably the supply that they've been dealing with for a long time, and as such, I'm not sure if it's possible for them to work with these suppliers to actually ensure and do proper due diligence to ensure that these suppliers are fit for purpose in terms of they personally as suppliers are not contributing to the conflict in these areas through whatever means. But of course, that also brings its own difficulties when it comes to those suppliers in those regions. They are an economic player and the economic resources would flow within the country, and that could lead to further support of the conflict in itself. But I think taking that targeted approach could be a way forward instead of blanket stopping of sourcing from this particular countries. But of course, there are also policies that prevent sourcing from those countries. It might be that a country has put in place, or let's say the UK or the US has put in place policies that would make it quite difficult to source from those countries, and then that could also bring about more difficult economic ways of operating, whereas prices of the supplies go up significantly, perhaps from tariffs, for example, where sourcing from other countries might cause the cost of their operations to go up significantly. That would be one of the things that businesses would also look at. So I think taking a comprehensive approach, looking at things in different ways, in different scenarios, and looking at the specificity of the issue at hand could also play a role in crafting perhaps better policies that will not penalize even people that are not in support of such conflict.
Yeah, I think that's very helpful, because I think there's a message there about not rushing into anything, taking time, consulting, assessing the impacts and the implications before introducing a policy. And how long did you say it took Co-op? Over a year, was it?
Yeah, over a year.
Over a year. And I think I think that's important. When you're making in such an important decision about who you do and don't supply from, particularly when you've got people within your supply chain who might be implicated, then it's important that you take some time to do that and do it properly and understand the impacts, the implications, and the unintended consequences. I know we're going to potentially be talking about this on a future episode in the context not of conflict or human rights violations, but in the context of carbon emissions. How do we reduce our emissions when we're sourcing from faraway countries, potentially importing produce via different modes of transport? Should we be stopping that to save emissions? And of course, that raises also all kinds of ethical questions, similar, although very different in terms of, the context. We're not talking about, here we're talking about conflict. With carbon emissions, it's different, although longer term, you could say, people are also negatively impacted. So, I don't know, Ebenezer, is there anything you want to say more on sustainable sourcing before we move on to plastics?
Thanks, Simon. I think you and Shay have covered things very well. I think it will continue to be a thorny issue because as I said before, they have very, very strong feelings. You know, before we got to this bit that we're currently in of this decade, where there's a lot of conflicts, even before we got to this point, there was already a lot of strong feeling when it comes to sourcing around the environment. And we all remember years ago, about 2 or 3 to 4 years ago, seeing in the news different brands being targeted, and obviously questions being asked of them of where they sourced their products from, and whether those places had the right environmental standards, labor standards, etc., etc. So, you know, before we got to this point, there were many questions already being asked of brands, and I think this sort of situation, in terms of the conflicts that we have in the world, is only throwing fuel on the fire. So it will continue to be a thorny issue, and I think businesses and brands will continue to be influenced by their customers, and they may have to make the intentional decision to try and reach out for a balanced solution, and they would have to do that intentionally. Otherwise, it's always going to be the case of them being pushed one way or the other by their customers and by consumers, which, as you rightly said, Simon, could be very dangerous, because then it means that potentially they may be taking sides. So a very tricky issue. And yeah, hopefully we can adopt a more balanced approach as we move along.
Yeah, and, you know, very difficult for us to talk about this comprehensively and fairly within a short space of time. So I'm sure we'll come back to it on a future episode. Because, you know, these kinds of decisions are sadly decisions that often have to be made. So this isn't going away when it comes to this kind of policy making. And Ebenezer, I have to say, I was very impressed that I somehow received an email from you as you were speaking. So I just popped up on my computer. So I'm not quite sure how you managed that. But
very impressed, Simon. Multitasking. Walking and chewing gum.
No, it's perhaps the reader without a chair should be given a chair.
Exactly. So, if I'm working this hard, I need to have a chair.
No, you do, absolutely. Well, okay, well, we are moving on now to plastics. I'm not sure if we're going to have time to cover Earth Overshoot Day and the economic paradox. So we might have to overshoot that topic to the next episode, but we'll see how we get on. Because I don't think plastics is one that we can cover in just a few minutes. It's such a big topic, and obviously lots going on at the moment in terms of those talks in Geneva, the Global Plastics Treaty, the whole debate over bioplastics. You know, lots of sort of articles popped up in my LinkedIn newsfeed quite recently about that. And, you know, obviously this is a topic that, you know, all three of us have been very much involved in. Some of the research work that we've doing recently, looking into alternatives to plastics in packaging, in agriculture, and in workwear as well. So lots here to unpack. Excuse the pun. And of course, linked to that as well, you know, Shay, you were talking about greenwash. You know, lots of claims and counterclaims over what is sustainable, what's not sustainable, everyone pushing, you know, bioplastics, saying, yeah, this is the future. But and on the other hand, others saying, hang on a minute, bioplastics can do more harm than good. And, you know, actually, you know, we should be, you know, some even say, you know, we shouldn't be rushing out of plastics because they still have a role to play. And then regulations. Again, Shay, you mentioned regulations. There are some regulations, including some of the new regulations around packaging and waste. I think looking at extended producer responsibility systems that, you know, penalise non-plastics more than plastics. So actually the incentive is to, you know, even there was an example recently around, I think, glass. So, you know, it's better
to go out of glass and into plastics because it's got lower tariffs associated with it. So it's such a difficult area to navigate. Where do we start here? Well, let's start with the progress that we're making. Are we making good progress here? You know, or is it just too slow? Ebenezer?
Yeah, thanks, Simon. I think obviously when it comes to plastics, we are at a very pivotal time with the talks in Geneva. And there is the hope that from those discussions will emerge some kind of an abiding treaty. But of course, it's not just about having a treaty for the sake of having one, but it's about having the right treaty that is balanced and actually has the right mechanisms that is actually going to deliver a series of very positive, constructive, and impactful deliverables and outcomes for all the countries involved. And of course, when it comes to the progress, there is the adage that says that Rome wasn't built in a day. We should expect progress to be painfully slow with these kinds of processes, not least because we are looking to try and sort of square a circle effectively, because we're looking at all the needs and the demands and the preferences of all the countries involved and trying to come up with something that, you know, satisfies everybody, which is in itself, you know, pretty much some would say an impossible task. But we've also got those who feel strongly against it from the plastics industry, who may want to be brought into that process, and there's a bit of work that needs to be done there. I always say to people, it's, you know, when it comes to plastic, it's not necessarily the material itself that is the problem, but it's, you know, to some extent what we're doing with it and, you know, how we manage the waste that it's creating. And so I think progress being slow should be within our expectation, but that should not deter us from the goal, which is that, look, plastic pollution is a very massive problem and we've got to find a way to address it. We've got to find a way to solve that issue, or it's just going to keep getting worse and worse, and we're going to have a much bigger problem, you know, on our hands. So my hope is that we have something come out of the negotiations in Geneva that moves us that bit further away from conventional plastic products and much more towards plastic alternatives and non-plastic substitutes. If we don't get that in the treaty, then in my mind, we will have a treaty, but it will be a treaty with a big hole in it.
Yeah, and I guess my question is, what does that look like in terms of any regulations that might come out of it and any implications for businesses? What should businesses be looking out for from these talks in Geneva? You know, are we suddenly going to find that, you know, often when we talk about packaging when it comes to plastics, obviously there's a lot more uses of plastics, but it's one of those areas that comes up quite often. But, you know, do we suddenly need to find, you know, that we can't use and rely on the kind of packaging that we have been using for years and years? And you know, is that reflected in the regulations, in the taxation? And, you know, any sort of regulatory bans on certain materials. And what does that mean for businesses? Do we suddenly find that actually, you know, it's going to cost a lot more to implement the alternatives? Are the alternatives already out there? And actually, could there be more negatives or potential negatives that we need to be mindful of, such as higher carbon emissions? You know, if we're sourcing more paper-based products, more deforestation, contamination of recycling streams, etc., etc.
Yeah, thanks, Simon. I think, well, I at least expect, and I wouldn't want to prejudge the process. I wouldn't want to say anything that ages, well, let me say it doesn't age well once the process completes and this podcast is sort of out there making the airwaves. But if we do get an agreement, what I suspect, Simon, you will see in the agreement and in the treaty will be some form of regulations that are designed to incentivize businesses to adopt alternatives more. So you're going to see a few carrots in there, particularly in relation to single-use plastics, right? So providing incentives where businesses adopt alternatives in place of single-use plastics. And within the treaty, you're going to see articles and different provisions, I suspect, that provide incentives from a trade point of view for countries to put in place the necessary laws and regulatory measures to incentivize their businesses to adopt more alternatives in place of single-use plastics. Now, does that mean by default that the alternatives will become cheaper? Not necessarily. It will require some innovative thinking. And I think within the treaty itself, there have to be some protocols in the treaty that provides a framework for how countries can reach that point, where they take they creatively put in place the mix of policies that makes the adoption of alternatives cheaper for businesses. And this, Simon, takes me to the work that we've done within one of our projects called Fresh Pact, where we've worked with the Ghanaian government to come up with, where we've developed a comprehensive policy blueprint that helps the Ghanaian government to achieve that kind of thing, right? You know, having a mix of economic incentives together with other policy structures that helps to make the pricing of alternatives much more competitive when compared, to plastics. When it comes to the environmental side, I think yes, you're going to see more of a push in the treaty. I believe if we do get one, more of a push for alternatives. But of course, there's an environmental impact. When it comes to that, potentially there could be more deforestation, more carbon emissions associated with the the production of alternatives. The way we deal with that, I believe, is to make sure that we are reducing the production of conventional plastics, particularly single-use plastics, as we are ramping up the production of alternatives and making more alternatives available on the market. And the best way to achieve that within the treaty is to draw on the trade elements to make it more attractive for countries to trade in plastic alternatives and to have favorable trading arrangements between countries when it comes to plastic alternatives and non-plastic substitutes, to be able to reduce the demand within countries for conventional plastic products, particularly single-use plastics, whilst at the same time driving up the demand for plastic alternatives and non-plastic substitutes. And I believe what you're going to see in the treaty, Simon, if we do get there, is an entire section on the trade-related elements and the preferential trading arrangements that countries will agree to in order to achieve that.
Watch this space. There could be quite interesting stuff that comes out of this treaty. But I guess, we're all hoping that actually something meaningful comes out of it. That we have so many treaties these days that don't necessarily end up leading to anything. It's about time that we had one.
that did, at least giving us, I think, you know, clear direction, I think clarification in terms of, you know, what we should be doing and what the best ways are to, you know, address this issue, because, you know, I kind of feel that we're not making progress that we ought to be making, that, you know, the issue hasn't gone away. We see it in our headlines one moment and then disappearing the other, and we seem to forget about it even being an issue at all. So we need, I think, once and for all, something to come out of this treaty, which is going to push us all in the right direction, and do so in a way which gets everyone behind it, because, you know, that's always the risk, as well, that, you know, measures are taken, decisions are made, which alienate a lot of businesses, that leave businesses uncertain, that leave businesses confused and not quite knowing how to act, and that's the key here, that, you know, we need to know, you know, as businesses, we need to know what the right direction, what the right thing to do should be. It's a bit like electric vehicles, you know, when we saw, you know, the regulations coming in, saying, you know, new electric vehicles were going to be outlawed by a particular date, and then a new government comes in and changes things, that doesn't help. So actually, if we can have a treaty which gives us sort of real clarity, and gets everyone behind it, so we've got that real sort of strong sense of direction, and where we need to get to, then I think that's going to help. We're coming up to the end of the podcast, this episode of the podcast now. We're not going to have time to talk about Earth Overshoot Day, but, you know, we can certainly tackle that on a future episode, the next one. What I would ask is for anyone listening, if you've got any questions, if you've got any points that you felt should have been made that perhaps we didn't make today, please do let us know. You'll be able to comment on LinkedIn on the update on the podcast episode, or you can email your questions and comments to nevermindtheplanet@sustainablebusinessalliance.org.uk. And we'd love, you know, to have your questions and to have the opportunity to answer them on future episodes. So just to finish off, I'm going to ask everyone to give some sort of closing comments, thoughts based on what we've spoken about today. We've talked about sustainable sourcing in conflict zones. We've talked about plastics. And I don't think in the time that we've got available, we can do either of these topics justice, but we've given them a go. But Shay, Ebenezer, any kind of closing thoughts on what we've discussed today and what businesses should be thinking about with regards to these two important topics? Shay?
Yeah, thank you very much, Simon. Thanks for listening, dear listeners. Right, so I think finally for me, I would say, the two issues that we've discussed at length today, just a few of the issues that we see in the world at the moment, and issues that concern business. And I think we have a chance to craft solutions that would make a difference, but that would also be equitable and fair. So there is enough problems in the world, and I think our solutions, as much as we can, should create further solutions and less issues or less multiplier issues that we might not even anticipate. So taking time to make policies, the right policies, fair policies, will be as important as the policies themselves. So thank you very much.
Yeah, very good. Thanks, Jake. I think that's, you know, I'd concur, you know, taking time to think about, you know, the implications of the decisions we make before we rush into them. Because actually, you know, we can see so often that, you know, maybe companies seek to kind of be seen to be doing the right thing and maybe go about doing something quickly, only to find actually that what they've done maybe has the risk of doing more harm than good. Ebenezer, final thoughts from you.
Yeah, thanks, Simon. It's been a very wonderful, I think, podcast, looking at some really complex issues, really thorny issues that are very, very, very difficult to conclusively resolve in one podcast attempt of sort of discussing them thoroughly. And I'm sure we'll come back to them, as you said, Simon. But I think for me, if there was one sort of takeaway that I would like to leave listeners with, it's that we've got to really think about the purpose of our actions in these areas that we've discussed. You know, what are we really trying to achieve? What is the most important thing that we should be focusing on? Why are we doing all of this in the first place? I think purpose is important, because that, in the end, I feel, is the difference between, or comes to be the difference between, whether we actually make the right decision or not. And so I think it's important, whether you're in business, whether you're a policymaker in business, you're a policymaker in government, wherever you are, if you're doing important work related to these issues, my plea to you is to think very carefully about the purpose of what you're doing and looking to achieve, and is it the right purpose? Is it fair to those who will be impacted by it, or is it not? And if it isn't, then surely we have an obligation to look at that decision again and to try and to get it right. So for me, it all comes back to purpose.
Really nice thought for us to end on. Thanks, Ebenezer. Purpose. And I think that will be another topic for us to talk about in a future podcast as well. How can purpose drive action in the particular areas where we want to take action, but also how can purpose underpin our businesses to ensure that actually, you know, we're existing for the right reasons as well. And I know that's a great topic to get into for a future episode. So I think we'll certainly save that for another day. But I want to thank you, Ebenezer, and thank you, Shay, for joining me for this second episode of Never Mind the Planet. And we'll look forward to the next one when we continue to discuss some of the hot topics of the day. Until next time. Bye bye.